the book of Psalms, and we're going to turn to Psalm 1, the very first psalm in that quite extensive volume of songs. This last week, on Thursday and then Friday, I went on a road trip. It was a business road trip, actually, where I had some work to do out in Bozeman and in Livingston. I had five photo shoots at several businesses out that way. And although it's always enjoyable, I think, to drive in Montana, especially when you don't have to drive too far, it's about a two and a half hour drive to the first photo shoot. And then I did quite a lot of running around for a couple of days. Sitting in a car seat for that long, it gets to be a little old. And the scenery's nice, but I just don't really enjoy sitting for such long periods of time. But in any case, it is a seat that needs to be filled if the job gets done. We are planning, my family, is planning a road trip back to see my parents this next week. And I haven't seen my parents, and I think it's been over 6 years now. So we are going to be driving back to California to visit my folks, and that is a long drive. I don't know if any of you have done it. I've done it several times, and it's a long 2 days worth of driving back to where my parents live, and I'm looking forward to seeing them, but I don't look forward to sitting in that seat all of that time. It gets a little old just kind of staring out the window, and I guess I can bring a laptop and get a little work done on the way while somebody else drives, but that seat is not something that is so enjoyable to fill for such a long period of time. But again, if we hope to get there, and this is the mode of transportation that we need to take at this time, that seat needs to be filled. Even if we flew, still you have to sit in an airplane for a number of hours there and back. And there are a lot of seats that you and I sit in life. When we go to a theater, we'll sit in a seat and watch a movie. If we go out to a restaurant, we'll sit on a bench or in a booth or something like that to enjoy a meal. And people that have jobs, we've all heard the expression, a desk job, where somebody sits at a seat for much of the time. An airplane pilot, they'll sit in a cockpit to fly the plane. But this term, having a seat, is also used as a metaphor. And so the CEO of Wells Fargo, thank you very much, has a seat as a position in the company, and he has certain responsibilities. A police officer might sit in a squad car or perhaps on a motorcycle for a lot of their shift, but their seat as a police officer is a position that they have where they have certain responsibilities. And the President of the United States has a seat in the Oval Office. And this is a term for, in this case, it's both symbolic as well as being literal, a literal seat at a desk in an Oval Office. And we also have the example of Christ speaking of certain people in the church or during his ministry and the ministry of the temple there, scribes and Pharisees. He said that they sit in Moses' seat, meaning that they have a job, they have responsibility in a position of authority. And their role, people's role in these various seats, is designed to serve one or more purposes, usually more than one purpose. And some people would like to sit in those seats. You know, we might want to be an airplane pilot, so we train and we get ready to fill that seat in a cockpit. Or perhaps somebody wants to be the President of the United States, and I'll take a lot of work, and maybe you'll get there one day. But there are some seats in life, I think, that many of us would not like to sit in, that we do not want to fill. And there are some that actually we should never want to sit in. And one of them is mentioned in Psalm 1. Psalm 1, verse 1 says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful." And so it goes on. The next verse says, "But his delight is in the law of the Eternal, and in his law he meditates day and night. So this psalm briefly summarizes two different ways of life, two different types of behavior, two very different kind of habits that people have. One is the way of righteousness, and the other is considered a path of sinners. And there are metaphors used here, such as walking not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standing in the path of sinners, nor sitting in the seat of the scornful. So walking, standing, and sitting, they are all used in this psalm to describe ways that people behave, or perhaps do not behave. Walk is the Hebrew term halak, meaning to exercise, to behave, or to follow. So we're not to behave or follow the counsel of the ungodly. Stand is the Hebrew term amad, which refers to abiding, arising, to dwelling in, remaining, or making. So we don't arise and go down the path of sinners to dwell in that place, stand in that place. And sit is the Hebrew term yeshab, meaning to dwell, to settle in a place or a habitation. And in context, of course, to practice certain behaviors, make them a habit. And so putting to use the instructions that we are given in the Bible and through the church, we learn how to avoid standing, walking, or sitting in these ways that are called ways of the ungodly. And as we mature, as we grow in grace and knowledge, we are to increase in our efforts, and we have more, ammunition, or perhaps armor, as Paul put it, to walk in the way of righteousness. Now, this is not something that just happens automatically, you know, to grow in grace and knowledge. It's not like getting older where, you know, when you're young, no matter what you do, you're going to get bigger, you get larger, your body parts grow. It's automatic. It's not the case when it comes to the way of righteousness. We are told to grow in those ways, and God will help us in our growth, but we actually have to make an effort to do this. You know, growing in grace does not mean that we're going to grow in unmerited pardon. You either have it or you don't. And frankly, none of God's pardons are unmerited. Only the righteous receive them. It doesn't mean that you grow in free gifts, divine gifts. Let's grow in those. No, it's growth in grace means to grow in God's influence on your heart, in your mind, and then God sees, oh, how is that reflected in your life? How is my influence on you reflected in how you behave? That's what growing in grace means. And of course, knowledge, you know, we don't automatically know how to build an engine. We don't automatically know how to crochet a pillow. We have to learn. It's something we have to practice and put to use, and then we grow in knowledge. And it's the same with God's way. In this growth, we learn not just what to do, but we learn what to avoid so that we don't walk in the path of sinners, stand in the way of the unrighteous, or sit in the seat of the scornful. And so as we grow in grace and knowledge, we learn what sin is. We learn various behaviors or attitudes that can fall into the category of sin. And when we discover those, we choose, we don't remain in those. We go say, well, we're going to move from that. We're going to stop doing that because it's not right. Now, the way of the righteous is to choose that path. It's not automatic. It's to choose that path when sin is realized. And the psalm bluntly says this. If you put in, read verse 6, go all the way down to verse 6 in this psalm. It's the last one. It says, for the Eternal knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. So it's two choices here. It's the two trees, once again. And it describes, in the beginning of this psalm, the epitome of the ungodly, the resting place of those who continually participate in sin, as the seat of the scornful. Now, it's talking about certain behaviors, but it kind of puts it into this category. Now, seat is the Hebrew word mashab, and it refers to an abode, a place, or a situation. And so to sit in this seat of the scornful means to make it a regular place, a regular situation that we find ourselves, something that's regularly visited by us. It's a habitation. It becomes a habit of scorn, to mock, to deride, and to scoff. And it doesn't mean that, well, as long as we don't do it all the time, it's okay. No, I'm just saying that's what being in that seat means. There you are. Well, there you are again. You know, it doesn't matter how many times you do it. We don't want to find ourselves in that seat. And so mockery, in this way, it's fruit of contempt. And derision is something that it's not a place where you and I want to find ourselves. We don't want to be in this position. So the psalm, beginning this volume of music here, of lyrics, it tells us to don't take counsel with the ways of the ungodly. Don't put yourself in that position. Don't stand in that path. Stay away from it. And we're seeing, you and I are, the reason I bring this up is because you and I are seeing more and more of this today. More and more people standing in the path of sinners, walking in the way of the ungodly, sitting in the seat of the scornful, mocking those people who we would consider to be more conservative, or people that might have more biblically based values. People are mocking them and deriding God left and right today. Insult and disrespect for people that are not like-minded to many of that we might put into the category of the liberal agenda, it's something very, very common today. And we see it all the time, obviously in social media, it's rampant, but we see it frequently also in, you know, the news outlets. And I don't know if you can even call it news anymore, although I think there are still some stories in, whether it's CNN or MSNBC or some of these other sources, there are still some stories that are news there, but it's widely become, as we have discussed in the past, propaganda, as they have an agenda to push forward. And yet they call it journalism, they call it news, and people are becoming more and more brazen or bold in their attempts and in their efforts. I've seen video of left-wing screaming fanatics hurling expletives at others in the street, in a restaurant, walking by in a crowd, just yelling and spitting on people sitting in cafes. I've seen older people that have been pushed and shoved and having their possessions ripped out of their arms by younger, much younger people, whether it be teenagers or young adults, who are much stronger than they are, clad in black, of course, so they can't be seen doing such terrible things. You don't know who they are. There are professors, I've heard this personally, professors mocking God and Christianity in classrooms around the country. There are wicked men and women today that are portrayed as saints, wings next to their heads in murals and on displays, portrayed as being saints, while decent folks are vilified. And I've even heard recently that some have begun to consider belief in God to be a mental illness. Let's go over to Psalm 52. Psalm 52. It's no secret, you and I are well aware of heroes in movies and on the television programs. The heroes of these shows are people who break laws, they cuss, they engage in promiscuous behavior and other ill activity. Video games have taken virtual violence to outrageous levels, and it seems like the more graphic, the more intense, the more popular they are. Music has been for decades now been used to glorify immoral behavior, and people dance and rock out to the disdain of God, and they love it. They love it. People are thoroughly enjoying this today, and it's nothing new, actually. It's perhaps being taken to new levels, but it's nothing new. If you'd look at Psalm 52 and verses 2 through 4, says that your tongue, speaking of the wicked, your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, lying rather than speaking righteousness. And you love all devouring words, you deceitful tongue. But God shall likewise destroy you forever. So the evil of today is perhaps nothing new, but what is different about it is that it is increasing. On dramatic levels, it's increasing in its frequency, it's perhaps increasing in its intensity, and it's hard to avoid being confronted or being in the midst of it. It's beginning to dominate this country, and it's beginning to dominate much of the world. And even the once tame and, as my girls were growing up, a very enjoyable television network, Nickelodeon, which is a kids' channel, they have jumped on this, what they call woke, bandwagon. Nick Jr., which is designed, it's a subsidiary, or it's a part of Nickelodeon. They have two channels. They have Nickelodeon, and they have Nick Jr. And Nick Jr. is designed mostly for young kids, you know, anywhere from like 2 to 10, something like that. But they released a cartoon in the program called Blue's Clues. Now, I don't know if any of you remember that. Some of you, Mia, you might remember Blue's Clues. It was cute. It was a cute little show. Well, they recently released a cartoon on the Blue's Clues program. And this is a cartoon that's designed for ages 2 to 5. And this cartoon that they put into Blue's Clues depicts a drag queen that is singing a happy-go-lucky song about lesbian, queer, and bisexual people and how proud they are to love each other. Now, in this cartoon, there is also a transsexual beaver that has scars on its chest as a result of a post-operative sex change operation. And this beaver is happily going along with everything, and look how wonderful and how happy everybody is. In addition to this, there was something else I forgot. Let me see, what is it? Maybe that was it for Nickelodeon or Nick Jr. I seem to be missing a page here. There it is. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, so Nickelodeon, and I don't know if anybody is familiar with the animated program Rugrats. It's been around for a long time. They're doing a reboot of Rugrats. And in this reboot, they're going to be introducing a new character, which is in a group of families. As most of you know, the Rugrats is primarily about a bunch of kids that are all part of, you know, different families and how they get together and play and have fun. But one of the families now is going to have a single mom who is a lesbian. So last year, Nickelodeon began some of this by announcing, and again, this was just an insinuation. They implied that their star character on their star show, SpongeBob SquarePants, which is about sea creatures, that SpongeBob, supposedly they were insinuating that SpongeBob was a homosexual. And the reason, they can't say that he is because there's not a single episode that gives any indication, but he's a sponge. And he's square, and he kind of does silly things, but he's obviously a young sponge, a boy, wears pants. And in any case, he's never seen like having fondness for a female sponge. So, hey, let's just kind of say he's homo. So you see where they're going in this. But what they're doing is they are teaching children to love evil. Love it. Bask in it. Enjoy it. It's fun. Proverbs 1. Needless to say, you and I have to be very critical and highly selective in what we watch or what we listen to today, and especially if we have children, we need to be very critical of what children are watching, because who would have known that this would pop up on Nickelodeon? And actually, the article that I read pointed out that Nickelodeon's rates are like viewing rates are dropping dramatically because of this. But I don't think that's going to stop them, because there is an agenda out there. But we have to be aware of it, because wickedness is becoming more and more prevalent, and many people love it. They are being taught to hate the truth, to hate righteousness, to hate biblical values. Proverbs 1, verse 22 says, well, it's the second half of verse 22, says that scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. And so the immoral anti-God agenda is pressing forward. It is going to continue to move on as America continues to lose favor in the eyes of God. And we understand that in the end, at some point, calamity is going to come. And those who continue to sit in this seat of the scornful, to walk in the ways of the ungodly, to stand in the paths of sinners, that they are going to eventually be forced to eat the fruit of their own wickedness. And so you and I, we don't want to be a part of any of it. We don't want to have anything to do with that at all. Now consider a prophetic proverb, and this is about the second half of Proverbs 1, and it uses, this proverb begins to use wisdom as a metaphor for God. And so let's go ahead and begin reading at verse 20. Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief concourses, at the openings of the gates in the city. She speaks her words. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn at my rebuke. Surely I will pour out my spirit on you. And you can see how wisdom turns to being used to express the position of God. I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you, because I have called you and you refused, though. I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded, because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my rebuke. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock your when your terror comes. When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. This deathbed repentance here. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me. Because, why? Well, they hated knowledge. They did not choose the fear of the eternal. They would have none of my counsel, and they despised my every rebuke. And therefore they shall eat the fruit of their own way, and be filled to the full with their own fancies. For the turning away of the simple will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me, to God, to wisdom, will dwell safely and will be secure without fear of evil. And so we see then that this seat of the scornful obviously is a place we don't want to be in. And this seat, it really denotes, when you put it in the context of what we had read and also the Psalm 1, it denotes a determined level, or if you let me put it that way, of wickedness or a depraved character. And it's going to be met, as the prophetic proverb points out, it's going to be met with shock and awe. And frankly, that's because this is the only thing that is going to cause people to respond. So you can't debate with the scornful. When it gets to that degree, there's no reasoning with Antifa. They're not open for debate. You know, you can't try to have a constructive conversation with the woke movement or those of the cancel culture. They don't welcome it. They don't want it at all. I've seen people try to talk to them, and they just shut them right down. They say, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear what you have to say at all. And they just keep pushing forward with their dialogue. And it's in this way, the dialogue of the scornful, it's really just one way. It just goes one way. They don't want any feedback because their hearts are set to do evil. Proverbs 9, in scorn, has, I think, never been more prevalent than it is on social media platforms. Many will try to use and have tried to use social media to convince others of something that is wrong, that their views are wrong, and you have to believe the way I believe and think how I think. Well, I've yet to see anyone on social media that changed their mind about something after reading a post or looking at a meme. This has never, I'd like to see it because I have not seen it happen even once. I mean, and you're never going to find someone that's going to say, well, you know, I used to not believe in God, but after I read your post, I thought, you know, there's really something to that. I think I believe in God now. You really changed my mind. I'm going to start keeping the commandments. They already have their mind made up. And the reason they go on social media is to try to spread their own. Here's what I think, and here's why everybody else should think the way I do. I mean, you were not going to find somebody that says, you know, I was really against abortion. It's just wrong. But after I read that post you wrote about women's rights, and I thought, right on, you're right. Let's go get one. I'm on board with abortion now. It's not going to happen. Sometimes, I know, though, we get on social media and we just want to share things with other people, and perhaps we want to just share things with people of like mind. Hopefully, you know, it's kind of preaching to the choir in some ways when we just share, here's something I read, maybe. I know you agree about this. Maybe you should take a look at it. It's a little helpful. But what we do see a lot of in social media, and if you've spent any time, and I don't recommend doing it, though, but if you've spent any time engaging in some of these conversations in social media, we see a lot of cursing, of insults, of derision, scorn. There are many, many seats of scornful throughout the social media platforms. We don't see a lot of constructive criticism or, helpful debate. It's vastly filled, Facebook and Twitter is vastly filled with hate speech. And it's vastly against the people that have, biblical values. People, they would say, the people on the right. And even though we don't vote, people would put us in that category simply because we have conservative values. And so my point is, I wouldn't really waste my time trying to convince other people on social media that they're wrong about something, you know, surfing Twitter or Facebook. Those platforms are really not where we want to go. And I speak from experience because I have engaged in some of these conversations in the past, and I kind of feel compelled, since I'm ordained, I felt like, well, this is a place where perhaps I can help some people to understand what's going on, but never once was it met by somebody who disagreed with me and then said, oh yeah, you're right. Not a single time. All you would get is people that already agreed going, yeah, right on, and then the people that disagreed would just get even more angry and even throwing more curse words out or insults. In Proverbs 9 talks about this in verse 7, where it says, he who corrects a scoffer gets shame for himself. In other words, he who corrects one who sits in the seat of the scornful, well, you're going to get some more abuse. And you don't really deserve the abuse, but you're going to get it if you try to correct anybody sitting in that seat. And he who rebukes a wicked man only harms himself. The King James Version says, only gets hit. So do not correct a scoffer, lest he hate you. Or rebuke a wise man, though, and he will love you. Yeah, give instruction to a wise man somebody who is seeking wisdom and truth, and he'll accept it. He'll still be wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. In the fear of the eternal, this is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So those who seek the truth and to be set free by the truth of God, well, they're going to be open for correction, for reproof, for instruction in righteousness. But there are few of those kind of people that frequent social media. Instead, what you have a lot of are people with agendas. You have a lot of people that are considered trolls. I don't know if you've heard of that expression, unless you frequent social media or the internet, but there are a lot of trolls on the internet now. Now, an internet troll is someone who makes intentionally inflammatory, and this is a definition I got off the internet, intentionally inflammatory, rude, or upsetting statements online to elicit strong emotional responses. Frequently, trolls try to steer the conversation off topic to push an agenda. Now, some of us have probably experienced some of these online creeps that are out there pushing an agenda that are just on fire for evil. And it's to be avoided. You're not going to correct. You're not going to convince them otherwise. There's no doing it. And in fact, it's just going to bring more harm. And Proverbs 9 refers to it as shame for yourself. Romans 13. The scornful, they're in this category of ungodly. And, you know, we might think, well, this is a seat that we are never going to sit in. Why are we even talking about it? It's something I'm never going to be there. I'll never fill that seat. But is it possible that we might sit right alongside the seat of the scornful, brush up against it? You know, we might never be caught mocking or treating someone with contempt to the degree of the unrighteous, but could we be rubbing up against it? So we need to think about it, because some of us might be stepping in that direction. So the first question we might ask, and I've heard this asked, not particularly in this way, but I've heard this question asked, you know, are there some that actually deserve it? Are there people out there that actually deserve to be derided, to be treated with contempt? You know, there's a saying that hell has no fury like a woman scorned. Some people actually attribute that saying to something in the Bible, but it's not anything that's found in the Bible. The saying means that a woman who has been rejected, hurt in some way, can become a very dreadful enemy. But rejection, it's not limited to scorn in that regard. Scorn, on the other hand, scorn, that takes rejection to another level. But nonetheless, there are more casual terms that some of us might use on occasion that maybe we wouldn't consider it to be scorn. But could it be brushing up against contempt? Think of it this way. Some people make fun of others in a disrespectful way. They might say, oh, I'm just joking, I'm just kidding. But, you know, there's a little bit of truth to that. And why do you keep pushing that? Why do you keep doing that? Because it's hurtful. It can be hurtful. And the butt of a joke is a term that means the person that's being made fun of, they become the butt of the joke. But sometimes the one considered the rear end, they're not really laughing. They're actually hurt by this. And so we have to be sensitive about it. We have to be respectful. And Paul gave an example of this in Romans 13. Romans 13, verse 7. This is a This chapter, this mostly talks about being in subjection to others, but it says, render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear or respect to whom respect, and honor to whom honor. And so we are to treat people that deserve respect, respect. People that deserve honor should be treated honorably. But respecting other people doesn't mean we have to respect their wicked values, that we have to tolerate that in our midst. But even when we don't respect their values or the choices that they might make, the decisions they have, the opinions that they have, we have to be civil, we have to be courteous nonetheless. We don't have to welcome them into our homes. We don't have to have dinner with them. But we can disagree and move on. We don't have to make it a point to sit there and argue and get filled with frustration, because that's frustration is just a step towards hatred, which is a step towards contempt. So we can just disagree, we can move on, we can politely excuse ourselves from the conversation, we can walk away from it if need be. We don't have to make everything our fight. Matthew 23, something I have seen over the years, the last several years, is a form of contempt between brethren. I have heard people call each other names from the pulpit. I have, and I shouldn't not curse words, but still using terms that are, it's not anything that I would approve of. And it's just, we shouldn't do that to others, even in person, not much less from a pulpit. But it's not, of course, this isn't limited to the ministry either. I've heard and read some things that people in the Church of God have published that are mocking others, treating others with contempt, other people in the Church of God. And you know, people have decided, well, they don't like something that someone did. They don't like something that an elder said or that a pastor had printed. And so they'll write up an article or they'll give a Bible study or hold their own service, even though they're unordained, have their own service and give a sermon deriding some of the ministers, mocking them, making fun of them. I've seen this. It's disgusting. And I believe that this is, that's not only rubbing up against sitting in the seat of the scornful. I think it's sitting in that seat. Now, an excuse some might try to use is to say, well, Christ called the scribes and Pharisees hypocrites to their face, trying to justify their behavior. But guess what? We are not Christ. I think Christ is allowed to do that. He is the ultimate authority of the universe. Us, not so much. So let's not use that as an excuse. Christ had all the more authority than all the prophets and elders combined. And Christ also said this in Matthew 23. And well, I had paraphrased or quoted it at the beginning. Jesus spoke to the multitudes and his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. But do not according to their works, for they say and do not do. They bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. So he was telling people that they are in positions of authority, and therefore follow that authority. God ordained those positions, and we have to follow it. Of course, if it disagrees with the Word of God, you don't have to follow it. And that's why he said, don't do as they do. Don't misjudge people. Don't mistreat people. So we don't have to obey any minister in the church that tells us to do something that doesn't match the scriptures. But we do have to treat people, and not just ministers, but people in the church with respect, whether they agree with us or not. And if the teaching is a fit with the Bible, well, what's the argument? What's our argument? But I've heard people say, well, I don't like what that minister said last week, or what he wrote last month or last year. Well, that's just, you know, that's an opinion. You don't like it, but is it a fit or not? You know, I know people can rub others the wrong way, and I understand that people can be offended and be hurt. But if it's correct, if it's an accurate teaching, tell it to the judge. You know, we all have somebody to answer to. Every one of us has a boss, even people that stand up here and give a sermon at the pulpit. I have somebody to answer to. And if I'm wrong, I hope that God corrects me gently, but I hope I get the correction. I would rather get it now rather than later. And if the minister is wrong, well, they're going to have to tell it to the judge if they don't correct their ways. Matthew 18, back a few chapters to 18. But those are some of the ways that people in the Church of God can be rubbing up against, or perhaps even sitting in the seat of the scornful. And something else that we could consider is the workplace. You know, most of us have jobs where we have an employer and we have coworkers, and we don't always love our job, but we should do the best we can anyway and treat our people with respect. But sometimes we get upset. Sometimes we're offended. Sometimes we don't like the tasks that we have to do. And people, well, they'll begin to get frustrated, especially if it happens continually, that we might be mistreated. And so they might begin to ridicule their employer, to talk bad about coworkers behind their back because they rub us the wrong way. But if we have a legitimate complaint about somebody in the workplace, and this applies also for friends and family that might be outside of the church, if we have a complaint, something that is really bothering us, we should go to them and talk to them about it, and not start telling somebody else. I mean, we might be able to get a little bit of counsel from someone, like, what do you think I should do? But when we start saying, they did this and they did that, and I just ate it. And, you know, this gossip can quickly turn into contempt. And so we want to stay away from that. But something to consider is Matthew 18. Now, Matthew 18, these steps to reconcile offenses between brethren, this is primarily written to people in the church, especially when we look at step three. There's three steps to reconciliation. Usually the first one works every time. If it doesn't, the second one almost always works. If you can't get past the second one, then there's the third one. But the first two are ones that actually can be used even outside the Church of God, even to people that are our friends or our neighbors or family that might not be a part of the body of Christ. And so consider in verse 15, it says, if a brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. And if he hears you, if he's your friend, if they care about you, even if it's an employer, employers usually care about their employees, usually. Don't say in every case, but they usually do. If he hears you and you find a way to reconcile, well, you've gained your brother. But if he will not hear you, here's the second step. If he won't listen, take with you one or two witnesses, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And so if the offender is a stranger, and if it's somebody that we meet online, if it's one of these trolls, this isn't going to work, okay? This really doesn't work with people. It starts off by saying if your brother sins against you or offends you. And so it's talking about people that are friends. And so this could be people at work, people at home, people are in your family, or people might live in your neighborhood. And, of course, obviously this applies to people in church. Because if these two first steps don't work, then you go to the third step. If he refuses to hear them, then you take it to the church leadership, and you explain the case. There has to be a hearing, and the case is heard, and then a decision is made. But anybody outside of that scope, you're rolling the dice trying to use Matthew 18. So I wouldn't recommend doing this with people that are standing in the path of the sinners, walking in the way of the ungodly, and sitting in the seat of the scornful. Because, you know, we live in an increasingly polarized society, and it's probably not going to go well with those type of people. Almost guaranteed it will not go well. Luke 14. And so, since we talked about family and friends, you know, think about those people for a moment. People outside of the church of God, or perhaps they're even in the church. Do we treat any of them with disrespect on occasion? You know, are we talking about people behind their backs and kind of scoffing or making fun of something that they had done or an opinion that they might have? You know, a few months back, actor Alec Baldwin came to Billings. And this man, he came to do some filming for a movie, and I don't know what it was about, some kind of action movie, I don't know. It's kind of unusual for people to come to our neck of the woods to do filming for a movie, especially an actor like Alec Baldwin. He's quite famous. But he was staying at the Northern Hotel, and he shared a story of something that happened to him while he was staying here. And he forgot, I guess, his most important charger for one of his devices, and so he called an Uber driver to come pick him up and take him down to Best Buy over here on King to get a new charger. And so I'm just going to read what he said. He said, "I'm headed to Best Buy, and as I'm driving, I say to him, to this Uber driver, 'How far is the Best Buy?' The driver responded, 'It's about 15 minutes. I said, "I'm visiting in town, and I don't really know this area. And we're in a pickup, by the way," he said. And there's a pause, and the driver says, "Are you here for that Alec Baldwin movie?" And I had my mask on and my glasses, and I go, "Oh, no, no." I said, "What's that?" And the driver said, "I can't stand him." And then he went on to say a few other choice things. And so we get to Best Buy, and I take off my mask, and I pick up my license, and I go, "Hey, Keith, I want to show you something. I'm Alec Baldwin." And he looked at me in the rearview mirror, and he goes, "My God, you are Alec Baldwin." I said, "Keith, don't believe everything you read in the paper." And so Keith was quite embarrassed by this situation, obviously. Here he is deriding Alec Baldwin, calling him Alex. And he doesn't even know him, and he's not even really sure of the situation. And if he weren't an Uber driver, this guy probably would have lost his job. But he certainly was very embarrassed by it. But the point is, the seat of the scornful is not only a place that is speaking out against God or against God's values. It can be contempt, it can be mockery or scoffing at anyone. And what it boils down to, I think, is humility. What kind of humility do we have? Luke 14, verses 8 through 11, when you're invited to anyone, boy, this doesn't look like the right place. Yeah, that's right. When you're invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down at the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come and say, "Give place to this man." And then you begin to, with shame, to take the lowest place, kind of embarrassing there, being presumptuous. But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place. And so that when he and who invited you comes, he may say to you, "Friend, go up to the higher," and then you have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And so we see that this really, it comes down to a matter of being proud or having humility. And so our efforts should be placed in to see where can we sit with the humble. That's where we want to be, not with the scornful, because scorn obviously has no place with a Christian. And if we want to be exalted by God, we first need to learn to be abased right now. And so if you go back to Psalm 1, God has set members in the body and even in society as it pleases him. He is fulfilling his purpose. Daniel said that God sets up kings. Because we don't always understand why things are the way they are, but we know that God is in charge, and we should accept that, well, it's all being done according to his will, and be a little more, I hate to use the term, but comfortable with it. Not that we have to be comfortable with the increasing level of evil that's going on, but just be comforted in knowing that God's purpose is being fulfilled. And so he puts people in positions of authority, even in our workplace, our boss or our coworker. We don't know. God may have put them there for a reason, so that we can learn something, so that something that maybe has nothing to do with us, something else is being worked out. And there are many seats to sit in this life, whether it's a company manager, a foreman on a job site, instructors or elders, husbands, wives, students. These are all positions. Seats that people have. And there's a purpose being worked out in all of this. No matter how crazy things might seem to be getting, God is not going to forsake us if we don't forsake God. So we might get rubbed the wrong way in a job, or perhaps even at church services. Hopefully not, but it can happen. People perhaps, they had a bad day. You know, let's be a little more forgiving of one another. Perhaps we get offended. Maybe we even get taken advantage of on occasion. But we don't hang on to it. Don't let the frustration fester. We got to move forward. We got to stay focused on what really is important, on the end goal. And so, don't be overly concerned with everything that's going on around us with other people. You know, do the decisions of politicians, do we agree with everything that's going on in politics? Obviously not. But don't let them irk us to the point of scorn, where we show contempt for these people that are in positions of authority. You know, at the end of the day, we might be annoyed, but don't get so irritated by it that we feel like I need to give somebody an earful about this. Psalm 1, as I stated in the beginning, it talks about two ways, the way of the righteous and the way of the ungodly. And it continues to say in verse 2, but his delight, the righteous, is in the law of the Eternal. And in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the river's water that brings forth fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like chaff which the wind drives away. And therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Eternal knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. And so there are two paths, there are two ways, two trees to choose from. A way, in this context, is talking about a course of action, a way of life, behaviors, habits. Which way are we going to walk in? Where will we stand? Where are we going to sit? Let's not let it be with the scornful, because as it says, our delight is to be in the law of the Eternal. So think about it. Do we meditate on the law of God throughout the day and think about it into the night as we work. You know, does it pop into our mind? Oh, yeah, I remember God. Oh, yeah, I remember God. Remember that we're supposed to be behaving a certain way, have a certain attitude. Do we do this as we drive to the store, as we mow the lawn, as we walk the dog, as we prepare a meal? Does the way of God and the direction that we need to be going in enter our thoughts frequently throughout the day, as we read a book, as we watch a movie or listen to music? Or do we get so caught up in the strife and the frustrations of this world that we begin to forget, and we just feel like we need to let our frustrations out somewhere or on someone? Every step that you and I take is being monitored. Every seat that we sit in, whether it's a position we have at work or in the family, God is paying attention to this. He knows where we're sitting right now and where we stand. And as He monitors us, He is offering us an opportunity to sit somewhere else, to have a seat at His table, at His throne. King Solomon had what was likely that one of the most beautiful thrones ever designed. In 1 Kings, and I'm not going to have you go there, but it's described as a great throne of ivory. It was overlaid, it says, with pure gold. It had 6 steps. It was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the seat. And there were two lions that were standing beside these armrests. And then there were 12 lions on each side of the throne along the 6 steps. And nothing like this had ever been made for any other kingdom. It was, I'm sure, quite stunning. And I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the throne of the King and Queen of England, but wow, it's magnificent. It's beautiful. But God's throne, a seat that He sits in right now, and a seat with Him that He is offering us, is going to far surpass any of that. More magnificent and glorious than anything that we could dream up. And we have an opportunity to be there, to be a part of that, to sit next to the throne of judgment that Christ has, a throne of mercy that God has, the mercy seat, as reflected in the Ark of the Covenant. And so let's watch our step along this way. Let's be careful, because times are getting more and more difficult. There are more and more instances of anger, of hostility, of frustration, more opportunities to get upset and fly off the handle a little bit. And evil, it may be rising to new levels and spreading, but there are some that are resisting this, and we should be a part of the resistance. Some are using this time wisely to prepare for what is coming, not just in the near future, but also in the distant future. So I ask us, you know, don't get caught up in this muck and mire of the world that is spiraling downward. Let's be one of those few that hold fast, that are humble, that maintains our integrity, because we have a great hope of something beyond this world. And let's never, ever let ourselves be found sitting in the seat of the scornful.